This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by three great sponsors, Zola Wedding Registry, Stamps.com, and Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
It's a phrase we've all heard a million times, white lies. Probably my favorite definition of white lies is this one, untruths that reduce net harm. Or at least that's the goal. The origin of the phrase white lies is unclear. A few online sources say it has nothing to do with its current meaning and track it back to the sad tale of Gerald White, a good-natured liar in the 17th century who falsely boasted about committing a murder and was executed by the first Duke of Buckingham. If White's lie was the first instance of a white lie, then it also might be one of the first examples of a false confession. The Oxford English Dictionary places the origin of the phrase later, in 1741. In that year, the Gentleman's Magazine wrote that a certain lady of the highest quality makes a judicious distinction between a white lie and a black lie. A white lie is that which is not intended to injure anybody in his fortune, interest, or reputation, but only to gratify a garrulous disposition and the itch of amusing people by telling them wonderful stories. Of course, this origin story also reflects the possible racial overtones of the phrase, similar to the contrast between white magic and black magic and white hat and black hat. The phrase white lies has even found its way into legal jurisprudence and specifically the issue of police interrogation. In the 1986 case Morin v. Burbine, the defendant's sister retained a lawyer who made a nighttime call to the police station where her brother was being held and was told that his new client wouldn't be interrogated until the next day. In reality, the police questioned the defendant later that night without his lawyer and obtained a confession. In arguing before the Supreme Court that this questioning was constitutional, the Solicitor General successfully argued that Miranda v. Arizona, the most famous criminal justice opinion of all time, is in fact a white lie.
The purpose is to dispel what was found to be the inherent coerciveness of custodial interrogation. In that case, it is a sort of a white lie that seems to me quite harmless and, in fact, useful considering the purposes of Miranda. And the fact is that the police do not have to provide a lawyer. If he asks for a lawyer, they need simply terminate the interrogation. They only need to provide a lawyer if they want to continue the interrogation. So I think it's quite clear that there is no Fifth Amendment right to counsel.
Sometimes white lies come from the police, and sometimes they come from defendants seeking to protect themselves from co-defendants or criminal charges. In either case, my preferred definition supplies the question. Do white lies reduce net harm or actually aggravate it? Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Last week, you learned about the home invasion at Angela Eckler's house on Memory Lane in Conway, South Carolina, in the early morning hours of December 20th, 2012, and Detective Martin's subsequent interview of Eckler at the house on December 21st. After interviewing Angela Eckler on December 21st, Detective Martin took two swabs at her house for touch DNA, one on the front doorknob and one on the master bathroom door. The next day, Detective Martin tracked down the police report for the event leading to Eckler's fiancée, Adrienne Moore, being taken to the Conway Medical Center on December 11th. According to that report, at 4:04 p.m. on the 11th, officers were dispatched to the Tiger Mart at the intersection of Racepath Avenue and Wright Boulevard for a male with suicidal thoughts. That man, Adrienne Moore, was then transported by emergency medical services to the Conway Medical Center. Finally, Detective Martin presented a search warrant to a judge to get the call records for Adrienne Moore's cell phone to determine the people conversing with Moore in the days and weeks before the home invasion. The following day, December 23rd, Detective Martin visited Moore at the Conway Medical Center for an interview. Now, because this interview took place in a hospital and there was a TV playing in the background, the audio isn't great. That said, there are only a few key points from the interview. First, Detective Martin wanted to know where Moore had spent all of Eckler's money.
Were you buying drugs?
No.
What were you buying down there?
I wasn't buying anything. I was down there drinking, making money, hanging out.
Where'd all the money go?
Huh?
I'm not investigating the money. I don't care about it. It was all your money together. Where'd all the money go?
Right. The money went for, stuff. For, Christmas and things like that.
It didn't go for Christmas.
Yes, because I paid bills. I've been charging the whole budget thing.
So where'd all the thousands of dollars go?
It was $1,000. It went towards, you know, things, you know, that we needed.
So Moore's initial explanation is that all of the money went toward bills and Christmas presents. However, Detective Martin wasn't buying it.
So what type of drugs was it? I know it's drugs. I mean, I know you were down on Church Street. That's where drugs are.
Drugs are everywhere.
Yeah, I know, but Church Street especially.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really on Church Street.
Were you trying to sell drugs? Were you trying to do something that...
Yeah, I was trying to sell.
Okay, what type of drugs were you trying to sell?
Cocaine.
Did you buy cocaine or get some cocaine up front and owe some people?
No, I bought it up front.
Oh, you bought it? Who'd you buy it from?
I bought it from, like I told you, the guy named T.
You bought it from T?
Yeah.
In case you didn't catch all that, it was Moore admitting to using Eckler's money to buy cocaine from a man named T. Then, his plan was to turn around and sell the cocaine for a profit. But that didn't work out.
Trying to hustle.
Yeah.
But you weren't doing very good at it, or what? Well, who'd you owe money? They were looking for money. They said that you owed them money. So who would you have owed money to?
After Moore drew a blank in response to this question, Detective Martin followed up with a key feature he distilled from Eckler's description of the woman at her front door just before the crime.
Do you know any pretty black females?
In response, Moore answered with the following.
Sharetta or Charmaine Montgomery?
Yeah. Who's that?
Some girl that used to hang out with.
Who's they?
So Moore bought the cocaine from T, and Sharetta or Charmaine Montgomery was a mutual acquaintance. But how would either have known where Eckler lived?
Like, how would they know where you live?
I don't know, because one time they picked me up down the street.
So they knew you lived on there. Who picked you up down there?
Picked me up down there. What's his name? They call him...
Picked you up?
Yeah.
The bleeped out name in this clip belongs to a man I'll be referring to as Mr. K for legal reasons. Anytime you hear a name bleeped out in this and future episodes, that's someone referring to Mr. K. Additionally, according to Moore, Mr. K had a car that was similar to the car that stopped by Eckler's house on the afternoon before the home invasion.
Do you know any of the guys that have a car that doesn't open up, the driver door doesn't open up? Like you had to get in the passenger seat?
That would probably be
a car like that?
Yeah.
And why would they think Moore had enough money to justify a home invasion?
Did they think you had some money? I mean, like, it seems like a lot to think that you had enough that...
I mean, when I was out there hustling, I had money.
Like, how much money are we talking?
I could go to the ATM and, I was spending money, but...
It was money. It wasn't like you were making money, you were just spending the money you had.
So according to Moore, he didn't owe T and Mr. K any money, but Montgomery owed them money, and because Moore was spending a bunch of Eckler's money when he was with Montgomery, they may have thought he had a lot of money that was ripe for the taking. Detective Martin then concluded the interview by asking the question everyone might be wondering.
Man, you don't have a criminal history. What made this decision to jump into a life of crime? Bad decision?
Terrible decision. Money was down, easy way to make a quick buck.
It's not, though, is it?
It's not at all.
You gotta keep...
She won't talk to me.
No?
I never wanted to.
So after spending his time in South Carolina on the straight and narrow, Moore tried to cut some corners, sling some dope, and make a quick buck. As a result, he threw his life and his relationship away and caused his fiance and her daughter irreparable harm. In the end, all he could do was let out a long sigh.
I hear for spilling me. And I am going down slow.
Postage rates have gone up again. That means that trips to the post office aren't just a hassle, they're more expensive. But thanks to Stamps.com, just like me, you don't have to worry about it ever again. Just use Stamps.com to automatically calculate and print the correct amount of postage for every letter and package you send. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail, using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. Stamps.com saves you money. They give you postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including 3 cents off every first class stamp. Anything you can do at the post office, you can now do from your desk. You'll never have to go to the post office again. And right now, Undisclosed listeners, you can use my code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial that includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's stamps.com, enter UNDISCLOSED, and sign up today. With stamps.com, you'll never have to go to the post office again. After interviewing Moore, Detective Martin used cop link and DMV information to get a match on Mr. K's identity, which Moore was later able to confirm. And after some back and forth with Moore and an effort to identify the female Moore had mentioned, Detective Martin was able to utilize the DMV database to get a positive match for a woman named D'Angela Montgomery. After taking Christmas Eve and Christmas Day off, Detective Martin emailed SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, requesting a photo lineup that included a photo of D'Angela Montgomery. The next day, December 27th, Detective Martin got a 6-photo lineup with D'Angela Montgomery's photo in position number 3. The following day, he received more cell phone records from Verizon. According to those records, on December 19th, just hours before the home invasion at Eckler's house, Moore received 2 text messages from a man identifying himself as T. The first one came in at 9:57 a.m. and read, "What's up, T?" The second one was received at 3:37 p.m. and said, "Man, this your boy T. Never hear from you. What's good?" On December 29th, Detective Martin again met with Angela Eckler. He first showed her a photo lineup with Mr. K, but she wasn't able to identify him as the man who came to her house on the afternoon of the 19th, looking for Dre or Drake. Martin then showed her the lineup with D'Angela Montgomery. Eckler, however, couldn't say whether any of the photos were of the woman who showed up at her door. According to Eckler, quote, "None of the females looked as pretty as the female on her doorstep." When Detective Martin told Eckler that the woman in photo number 3 was Montgomery, Eckler, quote, "identified that it was very possible it was her, but since the female she saw had longer hair and makeup on, there is no way for her to be 100%. Subsequently, Detective Martin obtained search warrants for the cell phone records for Montgomery, Mr. K, and T. Finally, Detective Martin came back to Eckler with photos of Montgomery that he had printed from her Facebook page. Upon being shown these photos, quote, "she felt confident that it was the female on her front porch. She remarked how different the photo lineup was from the female on Facebook." Subsequently, on January 11th, 2013, Detective Martin and another detective, Detective Hardy, interviewed D'Angela Montgomery at the J. Reuben Long Detention Center at 9:41 a.m. She was there after being arrested in connection with an unrelated armed robbery that occurred on December 28th. In that robbery, Montgomery had allegedly lured a man to an address to be robbed. She was being held at the detention center on a $20,000 bond. Detective Martin begins the interview by reading Montgomery the Miranda warnings.
"Because we're in this nice little room, you watch TV, right? I'm going to read your rights, okay? You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to talk with an attorney and have him present with you. Why are you being questioned? If you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, won't be appointed to represent you before any questioning if you so desire. If you make a statement or answer any questions, you have the right to stop at any time. Do you understand the rights as I've read them to you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay. If you just want to initial next to yes."
Detective Martin then asks Montgomery whether she knows a man named Adrian who goes by the name Dre, and he shows her a photo of Adrian Moore.
Drake? No, I do not know him.
With Montgomery claiming that she doesn't know Adrian Moore, Detective Merton then directs Montgomery's attention to an incident at a hotel in December.
To be honest, I was...
You were in a hotel room with him?
I used to do drugs, and I really do not.
Like last month? You were doing drugs?
Yeah, I was, yeah, mm-hmm. last month.
Because you called the police from a hotel room, and he was there with you. Could that have happened in Conway?
I do not know him.
This shift in focus seems to spark Montgomery's memory.
I know
Drake.
Drake.
His name is Drake.
Drake. Okay,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
I do know.
So
Drake.
You know it now.
I just had to, because it just looked funny, like, because I used to get high, and he was like one of the guys that I hooked up with. Yeah.
Drake.
According to Montgomery, though, she was unaware that Drake's real name is Adrian.
Well, his real name is Adrian.
Yep.
Oh,
well, that's...
As Montgomery notes in response to a comment by Detective Hardy, there was a reason she wasn't focused on his name.
Well, you didn't care at the time, did you?
No, because he had, like, a lot of money and stuff.
And some drugs?
He buys it, but he had a lot of money.
What kind of dope was y'all doing?
Detective Martin then starts getting down to business, focusing on the scene of the crime.
Okay. Have you ever been to Drake's house?
He took me to his house while his girlfriend was there, like, snuck me in on the side. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, cooped up, scared in a room. And he kept walking in there, and we were smoking, like, in the room. And then he'll walk back in there to her.
According to Montgomery, though, Ector never saw her.
Did you see her?
No, I never got a chance to see her.
Okay. Do you think she ever saw you?
No, she never seen me before.
Detective Martin then sets the bait for Montgomery to confess to the crime, but she doesn't bite, at least initially.
Well, tell me about the time that you and went over there. You don't know what is?
I know, but me and never been over there.
Okay, because went over there with another guy and you.
Me and another guy?
Yeah.
No.
Well, you were ID'd.
She must have seen, either she seen the wrong girl. Is the guy that we got the stuff from,
mm-hmm.
that me and Drake used to get the stuff from. So far mm-hmm. as, never came to her house to give us anything. When me and him went to her house, me and him had already had the drugs, and we always got it from him. He always came to the hotel, but me and never ever, that's like on my kids, we never ever been there together, like never. And I only been to her house one time.
Dissatisfied with this response, Detective Martin hopes that giving Montgomery some of the details of the crime will get her to confess.
You didn't go a time and knock on the door looking for Drake?
No.
Detective Hardy then makes one last attempt to get Montgomery to spill the beans.
So, if you knew Drake, you had a big pocket full of dope.
No,
and you didn't have no dope.
No, I'm just a beginner smoker. Like, I wasn't... It don't affect me like it affect most smokers.
How old are you?
21. If I don't have it, I don't have it. If I have it, oh yeah.
With these attempts at playing good cop with Montgomery going nowhere, Detective Martin decides to up the ante.
Okay, well, I'm not going to play around here. We don't got time. Female went to the front door of Drake's house. Drake doesn't live there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But his girl did, the girl that he lived with that you never saw, and asked for Drake. She opened the door, two guys go in and rob him.
And she said that I was with him.
That paper shuffling you hear is Detective Martin sliding the photo lineup over to Montgomery. This is the same lineup with the pictures of six African-American women that he showed to Angela Eckler. But in this version of the lineup, there's a circle around Montgomery's picture. On the left side of the circle are the handwritten words, "This is the lady who robbed me, she knocked on my door and asked for Dre." Now, this development is likely surprising to you because I noted before that Eckler wasn't able to identify Montgomery in the photo lineup, although she did later identify her from her Facebook photos. So what happened? It was, in fact, Detective Martin who had circled the photo of Montgomery and wrote the words that made it look like Eckler had identified Montgomery. This was Detective Martin engaging in police deception to try to get Montgomery to confess. Here's Detective Martin explaining his thinking while being cross-examined at trial. Question: so this is a lie. Answer: it's deception. Question: it's deception? You operate in deception a lot? Answer: sometimes when we're doing interviews with individuals, everyone's not always forthcoming with the truth. Sometimes they have to believe there's more information on our side than we actually have at that time. ¶¶ Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the U.S. As a result, their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. A couple of the recipes from Blue Apron I'll be trying this week are the crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad, and the udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Plus, Blue Apron has a freshness guarantee that promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. So why don't you try it? You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. The United States Supreme Court approved the use of police deception in its 1969 opinion in Frazier v. Cupp. In Cupp, Jerry Rawls and Martin Frazier, a 20-year-old Marine home on emergency leave for his mother's funeral, were suspects in the murder of Russell Anton Merlot. Frazier was eventually taken to police headquarters and told the officers that, on the night of the murder, he spent time at the funeral parlor before going out drinking with Rawls. Here's Frazier's attorney describing what happened next during an oral argument before the Supreme Court.
At that point, the interrogator falsely told Frazier that Rawls was in custody and that Rawls had told everything. In fact, Rawls was still free and the police had not yet talked to Rawls. The interrogator used various standard emotional appeals, such that Frazier should not shoulder the entire blame himself, reference to Frazier's dead mother. He was on emergency leave for a funeral at the time. And after that, Frazier admitted having been with Marlowe the night of the crime, and he told the officers what happened up until the time when the threesome arrived at the scene of the crime. Then Frazier stopped. He said, "I think I had better get a lawyer before I talk anymore. I'm going to get into more trouble than I am in now." The officer replied, "You can't be in any more trouble than you are in now," and then proceeded with the interrogation.
After he was convicted of murder, Frazier eventually filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which reached the Supreme Court, which held that the fact that the police misrepresented the statements that Rawls had made, while relevant, is insufficient in our view to make this otherwise voluntary confession inadmissible. These cases must be decided by viewing the totality of the circumstances, and on the facts of this case, we can find no error in the admission of petitioner's confession. In other words, police deception is permissible except in those rare cases where the court determines it was so egregious that it renders the confession involuntary. I talked to my colleague Seth Stoughton about the Cupp decision and the use of police deception. He's possibly the only law professor in the country who's a former police officer, and he's definitely the only one writing about policing in the law. I began by asking him about the reason why police deception is allowed.
Very, very few suspects are going to confess to crimes just because you ask politely. The short answer is deception is almost necessary to get a confession in the first place. The overwhelming reason that it's used isn't just for fun, it's because it's effective, or at least it has the potential to be effective.
Indeed, according to Professor Stoughton, if the Supreme Court were to ban or even severely limit police deception, it would require a fundamental change in the way we conduct criminal investigations.
Deception in interrogations is endemic. It's ubiquitous. If you prevented officers from using deception in interrogations, or if you sharply curtailed their ability to use deceptions, it would require a radical change to not just interrogation practices, it would require, frankly, a pretty radical change to investigative practices more broadly. So it would very much affect police practices.
That said, there are reasons why many believe the cure of police deception is as bad as the disease of crime.
Well, I mentioned it can be effective. Sometimes it can be too effective. It can result in false confessions or unreliable confessions. When officers are trying to use deception, they can contaminate a confession by providing information to the suspect without even necessarily realizing that they're doing that. So when the suspect parrots back that information, as far as the officer is concerned, The suspect is providing information that only the actual perpetrator might know. So there's a danger of false confessions, there's a danger of unreliable confessions and contaminated confessions. There are some, what we might say, legitimacy or public relations dangers, where I think it's difficult for us to imagine a police force engaged in widespread deception. That's not the way the public wants to think of its police force. So to the extent that overuse of deception can harm public views of policing, I think that's a real potential harm.
One thing is certain, though. Police deception is pervasive. I asked Professor Stoughton how often he saw police deception on the job.
All the time. All the time. I have trouble thinking of a single interrogation, either a field interrogation or a station house interrogation, that didn't involve some implicit or explicit deception.
Professor Stoughton then did remember some shoplifting cases where there was surveillance footage and no need to use deception.
Excepting those, I can't think of a single field interrogation or station house interrogation that didn't involve some level of deception.
So back to the interrogation in this case. Thinking she's been identified by Eckler, D'Angelo Montgomery invokes her right to counsel.
All those girls look a lot alike, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Which one looks like you?
And this one. And she said that I have a lawyer and I don't want to talk no more because this is a big confusion.
Okay, well that's fine because
yeah,
I'm going to go get the
confusion.
That's fine. Your lawyer will get it. I'm going to go get the warrants right now.
Okay.
It's going to be armed robbery times two and kidnapping times two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay, because I don't know what is going on.
Okay.
I honestly don't know what's going on.
That's fine.
Now, this very well could have been the end of the interrogation or any interrogation of Montgomery, but Detective Martin keeps the dialogue going, again hanging the bait out there for Montgomery to take.
I was giving you a chance to say what you wanted to say because maybe you weren't involved with it to the point that you didn't know what was going to happen.
Maybe he was made to do it.
Maybe he was made to do it, but that's fine.
So if I talk, it won't be more of like...
Oh. I can't say you're not going to get in trouble, ma'am, but it can keep you from whatever I'm going to do being worse, but that's up to you. You
well,
said you want a lawyer.
Yeah. I have a lawyer already, but I'm going to just be honest because this is like a real big mistake.
Two thoughts on this. First, this is the exact same thing that happened in Frazier versus Cupp, and in both cases you might wonder how interrogation could proceed despite the defendants invoking their Fifth Amendment or Miranda right to counsel. Well, first, Cupp's original trial was held shortly before the Supreme Court's opinion in Miranda, which the Supreme Court did not make retroactive. Therefore, he was out of luck. As for Montgomery, there's an argument there was a Miranda violation. But as we'll see later, there are two reasons why this never became an issue in this case. Now, second, what Detective Martin is doing here is very similar to what Professor Stoughton described as a common police interrogation technique.
Pretending to be on the suspect's side. Building a rapport with the suspect and telling them, look, I want your side of the story because it's important to me. It's important to me to make sure that you are represented, that your words come through, that the state attorney has a chance to hear from you directly through my report. To be very clear, I, as the officer, am not on the suspect's side.
With Montgomery having taken Detective Martin's bait, she launches into her story.
Okay, well, Dre owes money.
To who?
To these other two guys, and has nothing to do with it at all. It's not...
Detective Martin, of course, wonders how Mr. K, the man who came by Eckler's house earlier in the day, wouldn't be involved, prompting Montgomery to name the perpetrators of the crime.
The two guys are... I don't know the other guy's name, but he goes by the name of Junk and one of his friends.
Junk and one of his friends?
Mm-hmm. Well, they owe him... Dre owes them.
Specifically, Montgomery claimed that Moore had been buying crack from Junk on credit, and this entire home invasion was precipitated by Moore buying a large amount of crack from Junk on credit and then leaving him high and dry.
Junk, so he bought it on credit?
Junk, but he was spending like good money with Junk, and like most of those drug dealers right now in Conway, if they get a good spender or somebody that spend like $200, $300, and $400 at a time with them, or
they'll assume they'll
get it. Yeah, they like, yeah, this man got money. I don't mind crediting him and Dre, he was always the kind to say, when I pay you back, I'll even buy some more from you. And he always did that. Like, every time he paid him back, he always bought more. But $300, that was like a quarter was the most he ever credited. Like, he never credit. He credit, like, 50 or 100.
So it's like he stocked up and then disappeared.
This then takes us to late on December 19th, early in the morning on the 20th, just before the home invasion at Eckler's house.
And they came to my house. They was banging on my door with guns and stuff, and it scared me. They asked me, did I know where Drake lived? Because I did not ask for the credit. They know I don't have money like that. I told them where Drake had lived at. I knocked on the door for Drake, but I was pushed out the way. I knew what was going on while it was happening. Like, when I got pushed out the way, I just knew they was going in there to look for Drake.
Okay.
And I ran back to the car, and I was crying, and I got back in the back seat. But I know exactly what y'all talking about now, but I did knock on her door. I asked for Drake. She said Drake was at the hospital. As I was walking out the way, they pushed me out the way, and they was like, bitch, he in here. And
so you knew they were going there to cause trouble, but you didn't know what type of trouble.
I knew they was going there to look for Drake. And if they had found Drake, they was going to get their money from Drake. I knew that.
Detective Martin, however, isn't really buying Montgomery's claim that she was an innocent bystander roped into a situation she wanted to avoid, so he ups the stakes. Now, in episode 1, I referenced the Geoffrey Chaucer story of the Chanticleer and the fox. At the end of that story, Chanticleer turns the tables on the fox, telling him to stop and taunt the pursuers trying to rescue Chanticleer, boasting about how he has bested them. The fox responds to this appeal to vanity by letting go of Chanticleer to crow about his escape, allowing Chanticleer to fly to safety in a nearby tree. The moral of the story, according to Chaucer, is, lo, such it is to trust in one who flatters, be negligent, and act so carelessly. In his interrogation of Montgomery, Detective Martin engaged in just such flattery.
This one here, I wasn't looking forward to getting anything out of, but my name getting out of the whole thing, because
that's what I'm saying.
I'm not the type of old people.
You can't
do
two burglaries, burglary first, and two kidnapping charges. You can't.
Yeah, I know.
You're too young. And well, know how I found you? The girl said the girl at the front door was pretty. She was a pretty black girl, and I was able to link it up through other things.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty young black girl.
I mean,
and you're not gonna be pretty.
I wouldn't disguise my face to anything.
You're not gonna,
if it was something like
you're not
that.
Gonna be a pretty young black girl
for long.
If you take these charges for these guys, you're not gonna come out a pretty young black girl. You're gonna be 50, 60 years old. That's why you need to get your name out of this. That's why we're gonna find this junk.
After this beauty fades warning, Montgomery began opening up more, describing where Junk lived, the car used in the burglary, a Cadillac, and Junk himself.
He has, his dress is like real long. He has a grill in his mouth. He's probably like 5'6", 5'7". Like, probably like 5'7", about 5'7", or 8". He's not really dark, but he's like dark skin with brown skin. That's the best description I can give. I'll say he probably weighed like 280.
But Montgomery still claimed not to know Junk's real name. That said, she claimed to know a good deal about Junk and his criminal MO, which involved him enlisting younger individuals to help him commit crimes. In this case, the younger guy had the following features.
The other guy was real tall. He was skinny. He had loose hair. His hair was probably about this long. But he had like a hat on, but his hat was like turned a little bit where his hair was coming out in the front.
At times, Montgomery's description of the conflict between the career criminal Junk and his younger accomplice resembles a scene out of an Elmore Leonard story. For instance, here she talks about what happened when the younger guy lingered in Eckler's house a bit too long, pocketing some Wii games.
Junk was yelling at the boy, I know you ain't went in there and took nothing from that woman. Ain't nobody in there but that woman and her kid. Mm-hmm. He was like, man, come on, man. The other guy was like, I got some games. That's how I knew he was young, because he was like, I got some weak. It was like not the system, but games. Like, the games, the actual games that goes in the system.
But this exchange also involves a troubling trend in Montgomery's interview where she doesn't consistently use Junk's name and instead uses Mr. K's name.
He took a long time to come out, and when he came out, he was like, man, Junk was yelling at,
And here's Montgomery naming the man in the mask.
Did they have covers on their face?
The other guy didn't, but did. Had his dress covered up and had a mask on and everything.
But Montgomery is adamant throughout the interview that Mr. K was not involved in the home invasion and that his visit to Eckler's house earlier in the day was for a completely different purpose.
Went there because has his laptop, and he left his laptop in his car. And was just going to return the laptop, but she said he didn't live there, so still has the laptop.
In the end, Detective Martin closes the first interview by making it very clear exactly where she stands in the case and what she needs to do to help herself.
You're in this, and I'm going to try to mitigate whatever I can to make you be my helpful person rather than be the one that goes down for it.
Yes.
So I'm going to try to find this junk in our system, being that you say you don't recognize him, drive by his house, drive by his car.
If you can find some pictures now, I know how junk look.
Mm-hmm. And I'll show you, I'm going to bring back a picture so you can show me the junk.
Okay.
But to be honest, this is the only way you're going to get kept out of this.
Okay.
Is to ID these boys or whoever you can out of this group. Because if you're not, I'm going to close this case with your name on it.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Wedding is likely to be one of the happiest days of your life and also one of the most stressful. So imagine the advantages of one site serving all the needs of couples. Zola is a one-stop registry. Couples can register for whatever they want, sheets, a wine subscription, or honeymoon funds. Then Zola works directly with over 450 brands so the happy couple can find whatever they want in one place. Brands include KitchenAid, SoulCycle, Le Creuset, Sonos, Ralph Lauren, and more. Some other benefits for couples. It's available everywhere. It's the highest rated app on the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch to register on the go. Love it or leave it. Couples can have gifts shipped now, later, or exchange them for something they'd really love. Group gifting. Multiple guests can contribute to bigger ticket gifts. Price matching. Zola offers price matching to make gift giving even easier for your guests. Help with thanks. Couples can export their list of gifts and senders to make sending those thank you notes a snap. Finally, love from Zola. Couples will receive 10% off the entire site for a year to complete their registry. All the gifts, experiences, and funds you want all in one place. And now, Undisclosed listeners, you can receive $50 when you register and use Zola. Visit zola.com/UA for details. That's zola.com/UA. This first interview ended at about 10:15 a.m. After the interview, Detective Martin used Copling to match the name Junk to Jamar Huggins. At 3 o'clock p.m., Detective Martin returned to the detention center to interview Montgomery again. Upon Detective Martin showing Montgomery a photo of Huggins, she identified him as Junk and said he was the man wearing the mask and holding the gun during the home invasion at the Eckler residence. She also stated that it was Huggins' car that was used in the crime. The next day, Montgomery made a call from the detention center to her brother. As with all jail calls, this one was recorded, a fact that Montgomery likely didn't know, given that she spends a good deal of the phone call describing her involvement in the home invasion.
He asked me what drink at. I was like, shit, drink at home. Well, you about to ride with me over there because somebody about to give me my money. I want my motherfucking money. Okay, just because you see me chilling with this man, that don't mean I got anything to do with your money. That's between you and Drake. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's how really, that's the honest God truth how I ended up in the car and how they knew where the boys stay at. So it just put me in the bond like I directed them over there.
The following day, Detective Martin submitted the facts of the case to a judge who found probable cause to issue a warrant for Montgomery's arrest on the charge of accessory before the fact to burglary. An accessory is someone who assists the principal, the person who actually commits the crime. But who is the principal in this case? The ringleader, the man with the mask and the gun. Throughout her interview with Detective Martin, Montgomery claimed that it was Junk who had committed the crime and not Mr. K, who had stopped by Angela Eckler's house earlier in the day to return Adrian Moore's laptop. But listen to Montgomery on the phone call from the detention center with her brother, describing the ringleader of the crime arriving at her house on the night of the burglary.
And then daughter here and you talking about shooting up a spot that I don't even know what money you talking about. But you come to my house with another nigga. Okay, let me take you to this nigga house so you can get your money from this nigga because I ain't got your money.
Mm-hmm.
But Drake had owed him some money or whatever. He had Drake's laptop.
This only leaves two realistic possibilities. One, it really was Mr. K, the man who had Adrian Moore's laptop and would stop by Eckler's house earlier in the day, who was the true ringleader of the burglary. Or two, it was Junk who was the ringleader of the crime, and Montgomery made a mistake in explaining the crime to her brother. So what happened when Jamar Huggins was arrested for that crime, and what would Montgomery testify to when the case went to trial? Next time on Undisclosed.
I done had my fun. If I don't get well no more, I done had my fun.
Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. If you want to contribute to Jamar's defense fund, you can do so by going to www.fundedjustice.com/JamarHuggins. Even if it's only a dollar, believe me, every dollar helps. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Some of the music you heard this episode comes from Ward Dunn and his South Carolina band Pluto Wilson. You can get their music at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. The song you're hearing over the credits is the public domain song I Had My Fun by South Carolina bluesman Pink Anderson. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by using the handle @UndisclosedPod. And you can send me questions for this week's Undisclosed Addendum by using the hashtag UDAddendum. And finally, in 2017, the University of South Carolina School of Law celebrates 150 years of contributing to the common good through a hands-on approach to legal education, leading to a cutting-edge understanding and application of the law. The School of Law will also move to its new state-of-the-art home this summer, built with the needs of today's students in mind. We've made National Jurist Magazine's Best Value Law School for 8 years in a row, and were named a top 50 go-to law school by the National Law Journal in 2016. If Undisclosed has inspired your interest to study the law, we encourage you to start your journey toward a legal career by visiting the University of South Carolina School of Law at law.sc.edu. What's new?